Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Welcome back, Cracked fans, to another edition of the Cracked Interviews podcast. I'm your host, Alex Gruskin. We have another fantastic conversation for all of you listeners today as I am joined by Binghamton men's tennis head coach Nick Zazula to break down one of the best turnarounds we saw from any program across the country throughout the course of this 2024 college tennis season. Last year, Coach Zazula and Binghamton finished 4-20 overall on the year. Now you flash forward here to 2024. Not only are they 16-9, they're conference champions and returning to the NCAA tournament for the first time since 2013. So, of course, I had to have Coach Zazula on to break down his program's turnaround. We get into where they improved on the court. We get into where they improved off the court. We get into what a run like this means to Coach Zazula and this Binghamton program and so much more. Again, it is a fantastic conversation that I am certain all of you college tennis fans and listeners are going to enjoy. Of course, we also get into Coach Zazula's playing days, and I promise you're going to want to stick around to the end of this podcast because some of the stories he shares, unlike any I have heard from anyone in the college tennis universe. Again, this was a really fun conversation. I'm very appreciative to Coach Zazula for taking the time to join us on the show. I am certain all of you listeners will feel the same after listening. A quick note before we get there, we got a lot of college tennis coverage on the horizon. Previews of the NCAA rounds 1 and 2 for the men and women going to be available as of tomorrow on the Great Shot podcast feed. Of course, you can go watch those breakdowns live on our YouTube channel as well. Well, live shows Wednesday night, 9 p.m. Eastern time, Thursday night, 9 p.m. Eastern time, as well as we prepare for postseason play to begin. And then we're going to have a ton of coverage this weekend available on our Cracked Rackets YouTube channel Friday, Saturday, Sunday. So be on the lookout for that. Again, if you haven't dipped your toes into the college tennis universe, I promise you, you will enjoy it if you do. Again, a lot of great coverage on the horizon. You can find it on the Great Shot podcast feed, our Cracked Rackets YouTube channel, or across our various Cracked Rackets social media platforms. With that said, though, you didn't come to hear me plug our coverage. You came to hear another great conversation. So let's get to it. Here's my talk with Binghamton men's tennis head coach Nick Zazula. Joining us on the podcast for the first time today is a man who helped guide his Binghamton men's tennis program back to the NCAA tournament for the first time since 2013 this year. Welcome onto our show, Binghamton men's tennis head coach Nick Zazula. Coach, welcome to the Cracked Interviews podcast. Let's just start with the headline. You guys are back in the NCAA tournament. What does that mean to you and this group?
Yeah, thanks for having me, Alex. It's great to be with you. Love all that you do for college tennis. It's tremendous for our program. Obviously under, in the Division I era under Michael Stark, initially a ton of success in the America East. And then, Adam Cohen did a phenomenal job, continuing that and taking it to the next level, really. And then when I came in, we had just moved into the MAC and, started with some success, had a few dark years, in between. And so to be back on the top of a conference and back in the NCAA tournament is huge. The tennis tradition at Binghamton University goes back to Frank Pollard in the 1940s, 1950s. And there's a ton of alumni who have stayed in contact with us through for the Division III era in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. There's always been a lot of success in Binghamton, and Binghamton's had a great tennis community hosting the Challenger for so many years at Rec Park. And so to be a part of that history and to keep us going in the NCAA tournament, it means a lot to me to be a part of that.
Yeah, and you know, I want to break down the mechanics of this season as we go throughout the course of this show, but you talk about that history of this Binghamton men's tennis program and some recent history. In June of 2022, you guys moved into an expanded tennis center, right? A new home, that Lane Stark Tennis Center. I assume no relation to Tony, but for you guys to get a facility like that, for the athletic department to commit to your program and say, no, this is a program we care about. We're going to give you the resources to compete at a higher level. Again, to be able to deliver an NCAA tournament in year two with that facility, to be able to win the conference title in year one in a new conference. I mean, I think you've earned a victory lap, if you don't mind me saying. Just that has to be gratifying. It has to mean a little bit more, right?
Yeah, I really have to applaud our President Stenger, President of the University, and Athletic Director Gene Marshall. They understand what tennis has meant to not only the university, but to the community. And they stepped up in a big way to commit to the tennis program and to commit to the tennis community, because it's still functioning as a club, and membership and clinics and lessons going on. And so to be able to, you know, it took a lot of work on their behalf administratively to get that done with the tennis center and to get us moved into a conference that makes way more sense for us geographically. It's way better for our student athletes, way better for where we're at right now as a program to be highly competitive. And so to be able to, repay that faith that they put in the tennis program and in me, knowing that, hey, with these commitments, the expectation is that we're going to be successful, not only in terms of the way we run the program, but in terms of wins and losses. So to be able to, you know, deliver on that faith that they put into me, into the program, it feels good. It does.
Yeah. And, you know, looking at this year, obviously 16-9 overall record. I believe you guys lost just one regular season conference match before a pretty comfortable run to that conference tournament. You know, that everything is impressive about that. But to me, the most impressive part is where this team came from last season, 4-20 in that 2022-23 season. And, you know, again, I think I can bring up these numbers now without you jumping on me, because things have turned around here, but 42-90 overall in singles in dual match play in that 2023 year. Now you look at this season again, 74-66. That is a massive turnaround. To what do you credit that turnaround?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of things. I think, you know, and if you bring in the numbers from the year before, I think we were 1-22. It was even darker.
Yeah, we'd have to put a parental advisement consent at the start of this podcast if I brought up those numbers. So I was like, you know what, we'll go only 1 year back.
No, you know, I'm grateful for those times. They really, mm-hmm. I learned a lot and grew a lot as a coach. And I think part of that, when I came in, knowing what I was coming in behind, what Adam had done with the program and getting into the top 50. And I felt a lot of that pressure to worry about the results. And there's a lot of coaching decisions and things, and the way I handled some things in those first couple of years, which I was so fixated on the short term of, we got to get to the W's. But really ended up putting myself in some longer term deficits in terms of just the way I handled some personnel and some different situations. And then that, you know, there are compounding factors. We were playing a tough schedule. We had some injuries. We had the COVID, you know, bounce back and how that shaped some of our roster situations and what we were able to do during those times. But you put all that stuff together in the blender and you end up with a 1-22 and a 4-20 season. Now I'll say, like, you know, the last match of the year, we went 4-3 last match on with Toledo, who had a great year. I don't know if they finished, you know, 80, 85 in the country, something like that is where they were. And we were right on their heels, you know, last match on, 4-3. So those teams were battling and we were fighting last year. And I think we had some great senior leadership, and leadership from the captains, where even though we weren't getting the results, especially last year, we were laying some really good groundwork with a lot of freshmen starting, that bled over into this year. And so you move into a conference where there's a level difference between, you know, having to go head to head with Western Michigan and Toledo multiple times and having to play at their places with a lot of travel. We put ourselves in a situation where, because of the facility, we were able to get out of that 6-9 in the morning practices. We were able to play more home matches. We were able to have more favorable travel schedules where, you know, we're going 3 hours and getting out and playing and not going, you know, halfway across the country to DeKalb, Illinois and stuff. And then the guys knew that, hey, you know, we're in a position conference-wise where we have the resources to be able to win. You put all that stuff together, and it really changes things in terms of what the expectations are. And again, I started to go back a little bit, got a little bit negative on the guys early after a couple of poor performances in matches where I felt like we should have been right there, if not able to win against a couple of those teams that we played early and lost against. And I really credit the guys on the team, did a great job of saying like, hey, we talk about, you know, gratitude and being positive and having that mentality, then we got to do it all the time. And I was like, you know what, you're right. And I think we all dug into that a lot the rest of the way through the season. And we were able to play better. I wouldn't even say we were able to play better. We were just able to be respond better when, you know, we had a couple tight matches in the regular season with LeMoyne and things like that. And then in the conference tournament, yeah, in singles, we did great. In doubles, we had maybe our poorest doubles performances of the year. And we lost, you know, doubles point to LeMoyne, lost doubles point to St. Francis. But like the guys were just on it and we're like, okay, no problem. We know what we got to do.
Yeah. And again, the results speak for themselves. You mentioned some of those close matches down the stretch. What was it? 3 straight 4-3s to end the regular season, which credit to you, still a lot of hair on that head. And I can only imagine things got a little stressful there down the stretch, all road wins as well. But, you know, again, I know one thing looking at the roster this year, some of the things that changed, obviously you have some new players come in. Freshman Felipe Costa, 17-6 overall in dual match play for any freshman to put together that sort of season, but to do it in the top four, you know, playing those 2 through 4 spots all season long, what seemed to click so quickly for him?
His energy and enthusiasm. I mean, he's just somebody you want to be around every day. It doesn't matter if it's raining, if it's sunny, if it's cold, if it's early, if it's late. The guy's just always got a smile on his face. He is just so enthusiastic with everything that he does. And he's like a sponge at practice. It does, you know, we were late in the season. We were trying to tweak his backhand slice a little bit. And it's kind of like, all right, you're messing with some technical stuff late in the season. And he just, his eyes are big and wide. And he's got the, you know, the head nod. Okay. Was that it? Am I doing it right? And so, you know, in the fall, we did some good work with him, you know, again, credit to him and being open to stuff. I forget who it was. He lost to a match to Princeton, at regionals. And we went back and we looked at his serving heat maps and it's like, man, you're serving in the same spots all the time. We got to work on this. And he really committed to both out of the bucket, during practice sets, you know, during matches the rest of the way of really working on that, where he can start points in an aggressive way, as opposed, you know, it's like, you can't, it doesn't matter what lineup, who you're playing against. You can't play high in the lineup in men's tennis in college and just start the point neutral. It's just not going to end well. And you know, maybe if you're playing low in the lineup, okay, you can get away with some things, but he really committed to it. He worked on it and yeah, super happy for him and the success that he had. And just, it's scary to think about where his game is going, because he knows what he's got to do this summer and putting on a little muscle mass. He's a really light kid, and he's gonna be a player to watch for sure.
You talked about that energy and enthusiasm. I feel like sometimes that might be the most important ingredient to adding any freshman to the roster, is it's just like this youthful exuberance that you can't fake, and it kind of translates over to other players, right?
Oh, for sure. For sure. He's one of those guys that just, as soon as you're on court with him, your energy comes up, even if you don't want to. You just can't. It spreads, and it spreads through the team. He's a vocal guy too, so that helps in the morning. We, you know, if we are practicing early, or if it's, you know, the end of a week or whatever, and the guys are a little bit tired, we got like him and Andrew Fang, our third doubles team, is like electric. I mean, you can just plug your iPhone right into that and charge it up, you know, super speed, and you're good to go take on the day.
Yeah, no, I mean, again, it's not just him, by the way, as well. It's a bunch of different players. And, you know, I could point to a bunch of different guys. I think Will's who I want to ask you about next, because you look for Will last season, 7-13 overall. And again, from a numbers perspective, it wasn't the biggest jump forward for him this year. I think it's 10-10 is the overall record. But to do that in the top two, you know, again, that is a clear step forward. And I'm curious, you talk about starting the point more aggressively. Is it something as simple as a tactical shift? Is it just growing accustomed with the level? What has allowed him to take that next leap forward this year?
Yeah, it was a big step for him. You know, he wasn't playing one last year. He was playing one. He had a win over Pablo, the number one from NJIT, who I think he finished in the top 20 in the region last year. And I think if he wasn't in the national rankings, he was right there in that, you know, 125 to 135 block sort of thing. Yeah, I think it was both his mentality at practices, being a little bit more positive, a little bit more, what do I need to do next, as opposed to getting frustrated with this isn't going well today. And then that translates over into the matches. Okay, I'm not playing well, and this is what I need to do, as opposed to just kind of moaning and groaning a little bit and throwing the hands up in the air. And tactically, he was so much left and right last year. Just everything was parallel to the baseline. There was no ability to really attack and knock somebody out of a match. He could get somebody to hit themselves out of a match and make mistakes. And he did that against some good players last year, but he struggled if somebody just wasn't going to give him the match. So he worked a lot on that this year, cutting the corners on the forehand side, especially being willing to take some chances. I mean, he lost to Hibley from LIU in the fall in straight sets, different match in the dual match in the spring. It was indoors as well, which was different. But I mean, we got him, which is not something that he's accustomed to doing. It's like, okay, you got to crush and rush on some second serves.
Yeah.
Early in the match in a couple 30 all, like it's a big moment. That's hard for players to take that chance and do something tactically different that's out of their wheelhouse. But he totally bought into it that match. Okay, I'm going to do it. A couple serve and volley points at critical moments. That was one of the best matches that he played all year, and he did some things a little bit outside of the norm. And so he's another one. He's just in his sophomore. He's got two more years, super mature guy, doesn't get intimidated by anybody. And I'm really excited to see what he can do this weekend and in the next 2 years.
As a coach, how do you balance trying to implement those tactical changes with something you mentioned earlier, making technique changes? Like, you get these guys coming to school, and again, for we'll say 12 years, they've had the same technique reinforced by their coaches at home. And, you know, now they're trusting you, obviously, with a new ear to their voice. But, you know, you don't want to have to remake their game. I'm sure you're not trying to make these big adjustments. And yet, I'm curious how you balance those two things.
Yeah, I think that's something I struggled with early on as a young coach, especially coming to Binghamton. I think I was way too eager to make changes on both fronts, tactically and technically, right away. And I think one thing that I've been really trying to lean into a lot is you can be right or you can be effective. And sometimes you got to make that choice. It's great relationship advice, by the way, too, that I should follow more often. But I think there are a lot of times where I was correct in what I was seeing and what was going to give a player problems. But jumping the gun too early before you really had the time to build that trust and have their total complete buy-in to what they were doing. And so I think I've tried to slow down a lot in the fall and kind of let players dictate what are they willing and what are they open to changing. And I think I found more success with that as opposed to jumping in right away and saying, hey, here's what you got to do. So I think that's been a big change in how I've looked at things coaching wise. And then the second piece of it is trying to do a better job of showing on the video. And before I express my opinion, saying, hey, what do you, as we look at this particular part of a match or this particular stat from a match, what do you see and how do you think we could change it? Do you think it's a problem? And if, you know, we both do, then, okay, how do you think we should tackle? And then once they've started moving in that direction of, well, I think, you know, this has to be changed or adjusted, then kind of bumping the conversation into more of maybe what I think or what I've seen from the beginning. But I think that's been helpful with this group of the sophomores this year, you know, in our freshman class this year as well.
Makes a lot of sense to me. I'm sure engaging with them again allows them to just think through with themselves in a way. If you're just dictating it to them, they might not otherwise process things in that spirit. You've had 3 weeks since your St. Francis match in that NEC championship. What's been the focus. I mean, you win a conference tournament, you know you're getting an automatic bid into the NCAA. So you've had the chance now 3 weeks, dare I say, to ramp things up with the guys, taper properly. What does that process look like as you prepared for postseason play?
Yeah, it was fun. I connected with some coaches. This is actually my first trip to the NCAAs. We were close a few years. We were a bubble team when I was an assistant at Central Florida. You know, we weren't really in the mix. We were, you know, as kind of a semifinal team at Georgia Southern. And so I reached out to some guys and was picking the brains of some coaches and how they've approached it. Ron Gendron, who was at Bryant for many years and was the rep out of the NEC, and had some great teams. I had some good conversations with him, and you know, you really emphasize just at this point being sure that the guys are having fun and enthusiastic about what you're doing. It's a little bit of a weird time because you know what you're going up against in the likelihood of who you're going to face in the draw. You're getting close to finals times. It's a kind of a big training block. I mean, every other week of the year, it's like maybe you have 7-8 days and then you're playing another match. So it's a little bit different mindset wise. So we really took it slow the first couple days after, let everybody recover physically. We had a couple long nights. The NEC tournament was wild. We finished our Friday night match after midnight. Yeah. By the time you get food and do some recovery and wind down and get to bed, you're like going to bed at 2-3 o'clock in the morning. We had another late night against Lemoyne. So between all that stuff, we gave them a couple days to get their bodies right, to get ahead on their academics. And then we actually did some physical testing, which we normally don't have that opportunity to do at the end of that first week, kind of beat them up a little bit. And we focused a ton on doubles last week, trying to clean up some things that we didn't do well in the conference tournament. And then this week we were a little bit more scattered with where our practices were and a little bit split up in groups. So we went back into our singles mode, a lot of point play, match play to try to be in rhythm and ready for Friday. So I credit the guys. They've been really focused. I think they did a good job of getting ahead on their academics and being ready for finals. So they haven't been too stressed out about that. We've had some really good sessions on court.
Yeah. I want to ask you about the Stonehill match in a second, because 10:30 p.m. start time to any match has my attention. But the idea of a training block is fascinating to me, because you're absolutely right. From the start of the dual match season, that second week of January, till whenever your season ends, you don't have 3 weeks like you have had to work the guys, to develop all these different things. I don't know if we're ever going to get to a world where that's going to exist on the schedule. And it's not just in tennis, by the way. I'm sure every football coach, basketball coach, soccer coach, lacrosse coach, etc., would love something like that. If the point of college tennis is to be a development platform for all these athletes, do we need to build in more 3 week blocks like this? Like, I mean, it sounds like a basic question, but how valuable was it to be like, you know what? We're working on first backhand volleys off of a serve and volley, because gosh darn it, we have gone like 5 for 7 misses in our last 3 double sets, whatever, here. Just like being able to nerd out to that extent, it'd be nice to be able to do it more, I imagine.
Yeah. One of the things, though, that I like about having to do it, especially in the fall when, okay, we've got competition, we've got tournaments, we're playing, is bringing that mindset of the guys that I'm, even in a tournament match, even in a dual match, I'm not focused on the result. I'm focused on what is the process of what do I need to do? How do I need to play this point? If on my service games, I got 3 goals, can I finish that game, win, lose, or draw, and say, check, 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 yes, yes, yes. And my 2 yeses and 1 no. Now I know moving forward into the next service game, this is what I need to do. And I think that's what this team did really well. Look, it's not always easy to be the favorite and to know that, like, hey, we're expected to win. President the AD made these moves. You're expected to win. The conference voted us. You guys are expected to win. It's not like the gap was so big between us and the other NEC teams. It's like, okay, this is an inevitability that you're going to walk through. And I think that mindset of being able to keep that like practice developmental mindset in matches. And I think that's one of the big differences that you see in, you know, like when I got to play low level, but I got to play for Bundesliga team in Germany when I was at Central Florida. And there were some guys who were in that 21 to 23, 24, 25 range. And you could just see the number of matches that they were playing because they had stayed in Germany and they weren't playing the tour full time. The things that they would do during matches, it wasn't a difference of is their forehand weaker or their serve isn't as good, but it was that ability to process and think and adapt during the match. Whereas the college guys who were over there who had played 20, 30 matches, it was just another piece of the development. It wasn't something different or special to be in match play. So, well, it's definitely fun to have that ability to nerd out. And I love that during the summers. If we get a guy, you know, we're trying to get Will to stay in this summer, and I'm looking forward to that. It'd be to really like get really granular on technical and tactical stuff. I think that's one of the beautiful parts of college tennis. So you just play so much, you compete so much.
Yeah. And again, last one in this vein, Chris Alior is my co-host for the men's show, and I have this discussion all the time as it relates to doubles. His thing is just, he thinks players just need to put more returns in court. Like, that is his, I've gotten the monologue from him so many times about this, where it's just like, no, I'm just telling you, like, if they just put the return in, they'd have more of a shot. Is that something, is he onto something?
We got to get him and our assistant coach, Charlie Ellis, together. Charlie was an All-American at Georgia. We're super fortunate to have him on staff. And man, the guys, like, they have a hard time keeping it together, but he's on them all the time. But he's got some great stuff too, where he goes through the guys and like, okay, again, you know, we're going to break it down. We're going to get two returns cross court in this game. We're going to get two lob returns in this game. We're going to get two returns down the line. And don't worry about the result. Don't worry about if you win the point, but just, did you follow that formula for that same thing that Chris is saying? You got to get the ball in play. A little homage to my college coach. We had a wild experience. You could have a whole show about that camping with him, but never over, never in, never in, never win. You know, I got a little group of 5 and 6 year olds that I was working with, my son. And I was just teaching him that little rhyme the other day. And it's powerful. It's powerful stuff.
Oh, it's got to rhyme every time. My coach was the same way. No spin, no in, no win. So we come from the same cloth. That's funny to hear. You buried a lead there, and I have to follow up on it. It's a topic where I have begged powers that be, aka people with budgets, to let me go to Germany in the months of November and December and cover Bundesliga tennis, because it is the best thing we don't talk about at all in the tennis universe. There is team tennis, club tennis happening in Europe with really freaking good players that, like, again, no one knows about. Give me some stories. Give me some insight, because if you played it, I need to know more, please.
Oh man, that one of my highlights of my tennis career. And again, I was not playing in a high level league, but
still, so you're like, it sounds so cool.
Oh, it was fantastic. So I crashed at Nico Overkamping had played for Valdosta State and then for Central Florida for 1 year, and so he was finishing up some graduate work while I was the assistant there. And so I stayed at his parents' place in Bonn, and I just had their family bike. And so I would bike right through the city of Bonn and like through some fields over to the club. And I taught some lessons over there. Mainly parents were just trying to get their kids some English exposure in conversation on the red clay. I loved it. One of the things I've been trying to sort of work in a little bit that I love from over there is we play the match, and then whatever club was hosting, you'd sit down for a meal after. Okay. And you'd pass the schnitzel and the pitchers of beer or steins of beer, whatever. And everybody would sit down it was how you spent Sunday. I hated that they would play 6 singles matches only on 3 and 3. Like, there were enough courts, but it was just like odds would go out and then evens would go out. Okay. So I mean, it was like a whole day affair. and after 3 doubles matches as well. But I loved that sitting down together. I couldn't piece together much of the conversations because they were mainly speaking in German, and I was limited to like asking for a glass of water or a beer. But I think that's one thing that I'm trying to bring back. We've done it a couple times this year with some community service projects. We worked with Yale before the match. We worked with Niagara University and did both of those, some inner city community tennis events that I thought were great. And we got both teams together, you know, we had Yale and Binghamton guys teaching the clinic together on court, having to work together, get all the kids. And it was an absolute blast. It's fantastic for the guys and the teams to network. And some of these guys are going into the same fields and things like that. You know, they're from all over the world. So getting the opportunity to just meet additional people. And then I do think that has an impact on, you know, sportsmanship. You know, we talk about, well, there's all these great solutions. Okay, well, we can get electronic line calling, you know, on every court in the country. True. Yeah, you could do that. You could hire more officials. There's all these things. And I'm not saying those are the wrong things, but also missing out on that human connection and understanding that, you know, if we can look at this as like, hey, if I play better, you play better, we both win. And if after the fact we have a relationship where, hey, man, you go into business and I can help you out, and you can help me out 5-10 years down the road. How much more powerful is that than any electronic line calling situation that you can get on court?
Yeah, that is really cool to hear. And yeah, that community aspect of college tennis is what makes it so special. I was at the Varsity Tennis Center in Ann Arbor for the Big Ten Championships, and to have 500 people there, I mean, again, half of them drove. I was visiting my parents. Half the people at the match also live within 10 minutes of my parents, and you see at the local tennis clubs as well. That's what makes those sorts of things and these sorts of environments special. It's why I have always been gravitating towards the sport. And, you know, again, for people that don't know this about you, you are someone who has been a college tennis lifer. You were, I'm going to say, a standout player. I think that's a fair assessment. Standout player. You're all conference. Like, that is standout. Career doubles wins, career singles wins, records for you. Come on now. Like, that counts as a standout player during your time at Buffalo. But obviously, as you mentioned, you were the assistant coach there. You were at UCF. Now you're at Binghamton. What is it about this sport that has kept you in it for these past, you know, decade and a half now?
Yeah, I think that sense of community. I mean, I grew up in a fairly, you know, in the suburbs of Buffalo. So you kind of, everybody looked like you, talked like you, went to the same church or things, a lot of similarity. And when I went to university, both just in general, being a large state public university, but also intimately through my relationships with the college team, it was like, that was the first, I had a teammate who was Jewish. I had a teammate who was Muslim. I had a teammate from the other side of the world. I had a teammate from down the road, and all these things together. And we spent so much time together, traveling together in the vans and in tents. Yeah, we didn't have the budget. We literally stayed in tents. That's a true story. but you just get to know people so well and from so many different backgrounds. And I really just fell in love with that piece of it, as well as loving playing the sport. I grew up playing soccer. I played a little bit of football in high school. I did a lot of other things, but kept coming back to tennis. I love that international piece of it. I think it's really powerful to make those connections. And it's a huge piece of the education when guys are in college and you're in those really formative years. Yeah, it's important that if you're going to be an engineer, you get those skills, or you're going to be a journalist or whatever it is that you're going to do, that you learn those skills. But so much of the education comes from beyond that, you know, setting goals, working with other people, those dynamic environments, which you can get through a lot of different things at the university, but also having especially that international component to it and having to, you know, language barriers and communicate differently. I think it just brings so much more to the education. I love being on a college campus. My wife works at Binghamton University as well. She does student conduct. She's done residence life, and we both love the enthusiasm and you know, you're in such a formative years of your life. And so to be a small part of that as a coach and impact students in that way, and then be able to see where they go on to 5, 10, 15, 20 years later, it's really a fantastic experience.
We have to expand on this. You stayed in tents. Come on now. There's got to be a story there.
Yeah. So Russ Crispell was the head coach at Buffalo, but it was a part-time position. Okay. And so his other half and his other passion was he ran the Outdoor Pursuits program for the university. Okay. So camping, kayaking, all that stuff. He taught some classes on outdoor wilderness first aid and things like that. And so he had had this longstanding tradition of taking one trip in the fall up to like Vermont, and they would play, you know, like a D2 school or Vermont when they had a program. But the main part of that trip was that they would like spend two nights in tents. And then we were getting a little bit better when I was there. We had a good freshman class come in, and guys were enthusiastic about playing and competing. And so we started bugging him, like, hey, we want to play more. We want to have more opportunities to compete. And he was like, look, my hands are tied. This is the budget that we have. At the time, it was a very, very low priority in the athletic department. And so we weren't getting additional funds. And so we were sitting around just, and he's like, well, you know, we do that one trip in the fall, we could just expand that. And we all kind of looked at each other like, all right, this is crazy, but we just want to play. Yeah. And so I think it was like our junior year. It was pretty much every weekend, you know, we stayed in a hotel when we played a tournament at Harvard. But outside of that, we were going to tents. Regionals that year was at Cornell. Okay. And there was like 6 inches of snow on the ground because it's November in Ithaca, right? And it's like, yeah, that's par for the course. So we're at Teganic State Falls Park. And the first thing we had to do after practice was go back and collect firewood. Because it was literally 25 degrees and snowing. And at the time, I think a lot of us grumbled and were like, this is the dumbest thing ever. But I mean, we still, like, all of us would get on Zoom calls during COVID and connect and share those stories. And it was just phenomenal. And the really crazy part about it is, so I took that over that summer and I wanted to play a bunch of tournaments. So I came to Binghamton, and Michael Stark at the time owned the what's now the Lane Stark Tennis Center. And I was like, hey, we don't have any money. Can we just crash at the courts? Yeah. And so there's trees and some wooded property right behind where the indoor courts are. And that was outdoors during the summer clay court tournament. So there were like three of us that threw a tent up on the property and just spent the weekend up at the tent and played there. And so it's unbelievable. I have to pinch myself every day. I'm like walking back and forth from the new outdoor courts to the indoor courts, looking over at the spot where like 20 years ago I was throwing a tent living in squalor, just trying to live the dream.
That's good. It's your camping grounds. You get to pass them every day. I like that. That's awesome. Again, it's stories like that that make this sport so special. Again, I wanted to get back to this. 10:30 start time against Stonehill. Our club tennis team used to practice 10 p.m. to midnight. So that to me is prime time, tennis time. I had to be impressed that you guys got out of there with a 4-0 win.
Yeah, you know, it was the crazy part was it wasn't even okay if we just knew we're starting late. Yeah. We were on court outdoors for our 30-minute warm-up at 6:45. And it looked like we were in the clear with the rain. So it's 7 o'clock. And we're like, all right, we're 15 minutes away from start time. And one of my guys comes out with a migraine. We're having to juggle the lineup, and I'm about to make the scratch. And then all of a sudden, we get a couple sprinkles. We stop warm because we're like, all right, this is going to pass. We're going to play outside. And then the deluge came, and we're like, okay, we're back to indoors. And we were the last match of priority because there were two matches already in progress. And so it's like, all right, guys, I don't know. We could be playing in an hour and a half or in 3 hours. Yeah. Let's go chill out at Panera and just see what happens. Thankfully I didn't make that scratch before. So, you know, get a couple hours, the migraine passes. We're able to get, you know, the doubles lineup out there that we wanted, especially with, you know, freshmen and stuff in there. We got to be sure that people got one round under their belt, felt comfortable and things like that. It was definitely shaky. Will lost his first set. I mean, Jacob's a good player, but Will was not on it. But I think that also set him up for rebounding, you know, the rest of the tournament in terms of like knowing what he needed to do. But yeah, everybody else getting out there to take care of business after that long 3-hour delay and starting after 10:30. I was pleased with how they took care of business.
Yeah, that's the witching hour. That's when the real tennis is played. My last two questions for you, obviously coming up this weekend, you guys are in the NCAA tournament. You guys draw the University of Michigan. What were your thoughts when the draw came up? What's it going to take to get through that matchup?
I was floored. I mean, I was watching you and Chris and all the projections, you know, I was loving the Twitter content watching that. I was fully prepared that we were going to go play a 1-16 team in the country. So, I mean, you know, we're realistic and understand what Michigan still has done. They got multiple top 20 wins on the year. They're a first class program, but Yeah, there's a difference between playing a team that's 29 and playing a team that's 9 in the country. And so, you know, they lost a doubles point to DePaul early. I know they've shuffled their lineup. I know they've had some fantastic wins, but I think as far as we're concerned, you know, it opens the door a little bit for us. I think level wise, if you look, you know, you can argue ranking wise and results wise, there's a world of difference. But if you look at WTN and UTR, it's kind of the same gap between us and Yale. And when we played Yale, I don't think anybody walked out of that match going, oh man, we played our best match and they were just too good for us. We were all very disappointed after that match of thinking, hey, we could have represented ourselves better in terms of what we're capable of doing. You know, Feng went 5-6 at number five, and second doubles, it was a one break set where, you know, we got broke throwing two double faults in the game. You can't do that against a first class program. So I think the guys are excited. We've played some good tennis this year, but we haven't played our best match as a team. And so that's what we're really looking forward to, is being able to go see if we can put together our best match, three doubles matches, six singles against a first class program, and see what happens.
Yeah, and again, you're going to get to check out the new Milstein Family Tennis Center on the campus of Columbia, and trust me, it is very much worth the hype. It very much lives up, to the hype surrounding it. My last question for you, and you mentioned this at the start, so it's a fun place for us to end, the support surrounding your Binghamton men's tennis program. It takes a community for any program to have success. For those in that community tuning in, what can they continue to do to support your program, support your guys, whether it's recruiting, whether it's, again, showing up for matches? Just talk us through the best ways people can support this Binghamton program.
Yeah, coming out to watch college tennis, I'm pumped. I've already got a bunch of texts from, we've got, obviously being in Binghamton, a lot of our alumni are downstate. So we've got a bunch of guys who are going to be coming out, just going out to watch college tennis. So it was so pumped. One of our recruits came out to watch the finals against St. Francis, had to trek across the strait, stayed to watch. But I think junior players, it's talked to a shocking number who haven't been out to a lot of college tennis matches. It's like you're wanting to play and aspire to this thing, but you haven't gone and watched it. You don't even know what it's all about. And when people sit and watch college tennis, and they're like, so many times, even if they're not tennis fans per se, they'll walk away going like, that was so cool. Yeah. I loved it. It was great. The energy, the enthusiasm, the guys yelling and barking at each other. So go out and watch, you know, any of the alumni, make the effort, you know, look for where your team's playing. If they're in your city, near your city, the guys really appreciate it. It's fun to be able to watch, to be able to play in front of people watching. So that's big. Pick up the racket and play. Get out there. You know, I was up at the club last night doing a later session with one of our guys, getting in some extra work, and former player from Penn State, you know, many, many years ago, you know, was in town, was up at the club playing, and, you know, I said, oh man, I stink now. And I'm like, hey man, it's great. You're out here swinging. That's one of the fantastic things about the sport, is you can play, you might not play well, but you can play as long as you can, you know, move your arm a little bit, you can get out there and hit the ball. It doesn't matter if you're 75, 85, 95, you know, get out there and play. So I think getting out to watch, getting out to play in your community goes a long way. And then obviously if you've got the financial means, we've been super fortunate here with people stepping up and supporting. We've had you know, some great corporate sponsors for our home tournament that has really helped. And I know we've been able to partner with you know, Big Zeus barbecue in town. If you're ever in town, you got to check this place. We're going to get you up here, because we're working on some great events. We're going to get some broadcasts going from the Lane Stark Tennis Center. But you know, those things, those partnerships where they work both ways, where we're able to bring teams into Binghamton and say, hey, you know, go spend your dollars here. You got to feed the team. You're going to get great food. And then the local businesses really thrive off of that. And then some of the advertising dollars that come back into our program, we're able to put on a little bit of a better event and do shirts and have some more officials and make the student athletes feel like, hey, I'm at an event, you know, people care about what's going on. I'm not just, you know, at a tennis court randomly playing a match, but this means something to the people here in the community. And I want the teams that come to Binghamton, I want them to have a great experience, and I want them to come back and have had a fun time. So we've been really fortunate with that. And if you're in the position to be able to do that and support college tennis, it really goes a long way.
Yeah, hearing that answer, let me just say the success makes sense, and nothing gets a community to buy in more than winning. Obviously, that is something you guys did quite a bit of this season, as, again, back to the NCAA tournament for the first time since 2013, and in year one in the NEC, year one conference tournament champions as well. Head coach Nick Zazula, thank you for taking the time to join us. Obviously, wishing you and Binghamton luck. Don't let the Michigan degree fool you. Wishing you and Binghamton plenty of luck over the course of this weekend, and really looking forward to seeing you guys compete in the tournament.
Awesome. Thanks, Alex.
Hope all of you enjoyed my conversation with Binghamton men's tennis head coach Nick Zazula. A thank you to Coach again for taking the time to chat. Sincerely mean it when I say I'm wishing he and his team success in their round one battle with the Michigan Wolverines. And I thoroughly enjoyed every story that Coach Zazula shared. I'm definitely going to be having him on the podcast again in the future. By the way, speaking of the college tennis postseason, we're going to have so much coverage of it across our various Cracked Rackets platforms. We'll have coverage of rounds 1, 2, and 3 on our Cracked Rackets YouTube channel. Of course, we're previewing it all this week there, as well as on our Great Shot podcast feed. A shout out, as always, to the tireless efforts of our super producer, Daniel Westhoff, for the of an editing job he does day in, day out, making all of our content possible. Again, rounds 1, 2, 3 coverage available on our Cracked Rackets YouTube channel. Previews, recaps of it all available there, as well as on the Great Shot podcast feed. With that said, for the fantastic Binghamton men's tennis head coach Nick Zazula, our super producer Daniel Westhoff, and all of us here at both Cracked Rackets and the Tennis Channel Podcast Network, I'm your host Alex Gruskin. You've been listening to another edition of the Cracked Interviews Podcast. Stay safe, stay healthy. Talk to you all soon. Thanks, everyone.